Welcome, welcome. I'm Bill Tinker, and you're listening to Dialysis Talk on Blog Talk Radio, where we discuss the healthcare issues of dialysis patients along with other present-day healthcare issues. Dialysis Talk is brought to you by Dialysis Advocates. The information and opinions expressed by our guests are theirs alone and do not reflect the opinion of Dialysis Talk or Dialysis Advocates. We have a great show lined up for you tonight, and with that, let's turn it over to tonight's host.
Well, good evening. This is Bill Tinker again. Our normal host is out sick tonight, but I'd like to get them. We're going to have a great show tonight. We've got Dr. Robert Baer. He's a former nephrologist, and he's an author of over 150 medical articles, and most rewarding is he has a book that he did called Sorrow's Reward, which is a fictitious fiction about a fictitious clinic. I've read the book. I highly recommend this book for anybody that has anything to do with dialysis, from the doctor, technicians, counselors, patients, their families. This is a book that tells the story from all aspects of people that are involved, not just the patients. It's all the doctors, everyone else. So without any further ado, I'm going to introduce our guest tonight. Dr. Baer, are you there?
I am indeed.
Well, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
What brings you here? And tell us a little bit about your background and your current interest.
Well, first of all, I much appreciate the opportunity of being here this evening. My background, as you described, is as a nephrologist. I obtained my nephrology training in the United States and then returned to Canada, where I practiced at university health centers for over 35 years. I then migrated into health system administration, and subsequent to that tour of duty, have ended up over the past number of years working as a healthcare management consultant. And I only mention those things because as a practitioner, as a health system administrator, and as a healthcare consultant, in each of those roles, I had an opportunity to look at how we deliver dialysis care through somewhat different lenses. And I've ended up forming some reasonably strong opinions about what works well and areas that that we should definitely work to improve upon. So, having made some observations about areas of potential improvement, needed improvement, a number of years ago, I decided to speak out. As you mentioned, I wrote that book, Sorrow's Reward, that takes place in a fictional dialysis unit. And it just allowed the fictional characters to speak frankly about their experiences, not all of which were positive. And as fate would have it, the publishing of that book led to other speaking out opportunities, so I've had the welcome opportunity of being an invited speaker to a number of major medical meetings throughout Canada and the United States, and an opportunity to participate as a guest blogger and other writing opportunities related to dialysis care. So all these things have paved my path to being here today, to talk about what I've observed in the field of dialysis and the changes that we need to make to improve care. And when I say we, I mean patients, family members, doctors, nurses, other dialysis, healthcare providers, administrators. It's a team that needs to work together on these areas where improvement is warranted.
Well, that sounds good. Well, before I go on here with the next question, I'd like to let those who are holding on the telephone line, if you have a question for us later, just hit 1 on your telephone, and that will alert me that you have something to speak about on the show here. And Dr. Baer, you say you saw and experienced many things that left an impression with you and guided your course. What are some of these things?
Well, I guess the first thing that I've observed is that there doesn't seem to be as fine an appreciation as there should be about the magnitude of the problem of dialysis in our society. In North America, there are over 550,000 patients on dialysis, and many of those patients will have friends and family members, co-workers who are involved to varying degrees by that individual's disease. And of course, there's just a huge number of care providers involved in the delivery of dialysis care. So all in all, it's a huge number of individuals that's affected one way or another by this disease. And we, despite this, we just don't seem to hear about chronic kidney failure and dialysis the same way we hear about other important health issues in our society, the same way we hear about breast cancer or prostate cancer or heart and stroke. And when we do hear about it, not always, but when we do hear about it, it's often couched in terms of how expensive this care is. The billions of dollars that are being spent by Medicare each year for the care of these patients. And so one of the things that I've observed is that we emphasize the cost of dialysis. We don't emphasize to the same degree what is arguably much more important, and that's the human costs associated with chronic kidney failure. And these human costs are incalculable, and it's really what we should be focusing on more than we are. Hello?
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 Hello, can you hear me?
Okay. Yes, we got knocked off the line there for a minute. Go ahead, Dr. Okay. Barry, you still on?
Yes, I am indeed.
Okay, so somehow the phone disconnected here, so.
Okay. I was just commenting on the fact that, you know, when we in society do talk about dialysis, we talk about a lot of things, but not necessarily what a tremendous human cost is being paid by those who have this disease. And that's something we really need to focus on more.
Right. Well, what's the human cost such as what, the human cost that we have?
Well, for those who are on the line or who are online, who are patients or family members, the human costs that come immediately to my mind are going to be more than familiar to you. There's the anxiety of facing a serious disease without much knowledge of it, which often is the case. There's often an inability to work, which leads to financial hardship. And there are all the resultant stresses on family and friends. Patients who are receiving dialysis are often, not always, but often forced to make really important treatment decisions without being prepared for them, without the background information, and without being treated like a full partner in those decisions. There are the pains and the discomforts of the disease. There's the fear of not knowing what's going to happen and what can be done about it. At times, there's poor communication with doctors and with other providers. There are wonderful physicians and nurses and healthcare providers in our system, but sometimes those relationships are not as they should be. There are the concerns about being discharged from the clinic, particularly if one speaks up, and that can lead to a sense of vulnerability, and patients feel that they're being intimidated. There's not being suitably prepared for death. and on and on. And again, I think patients and family members and also providers who are on this call will probably recognize that many dialysis patients at the end of the day just don't feel like they have anyone that they can really turn to, who is knowledgeable about the disease and who they can talk with and share their feelings and concerns with and be given some support and some advice. The patients just feel like they're being swept along, that they have very little control. So they pay a big price. You know, it's not uncommon for dialysis patients to be depressed. Suicides occur over the course of their dialysis lifetimes. About 1 in 5 dialysis patients will just stop, just choose to stop their treatments. And I think these things are just some reflections of the fact that that there's not enough attention paid to these human costs and to the human side of chronic kidney failure and dialysis treatment.
Well, I understand that because I've been somewhat taken aback sometimes with some of the patients that we have with dialysis advocates when I tell people will tell us, well, I'm not going to go to dialysis anymore. I don't want to do dialysis anymore. And, yeah, of course, that's not a very good decision for them to make. But sometimes they do that because they're just tired of the feelings that they have, and sometimes they being stuck with a needle all the time, and it's a very hard thing for these people to do. So based on what you're saying here, how can we do better? Give us some examples of what you think the system needs to be changed.
Well, I mean, I can give some concrete examples, and then hopefully as we'll have an opportunity to describe, these examples all end up making a case for a need for higher degrees of patient and family engagement, patients and family being better partners in their care than currently exists. And, you know, I would make that case based on the following observations that, just as an example, before patients begin dialysis, they should have an opportunity to meet on more than one occasion with a team of doctors and dietitians and social workers and other healthcare professionals to be educated about kidney failure, to be educated about dialysis and their treatment options, to have their fears allayed and their knowledge of their disease made more clear. That kind of pre-dialysis care has been described as leading to better patient outcomes and has even been described as leading to lower patient mortality in the first year after being started on dialysis. But sadly, there's a substantial proportion of patients who enter dialysis without ever having had that opportunity. So they start dialysis less educated, more fearful, many unanswered questions. Patients should receive education, not just handouts or quick verbal summaries, but patients should receive education along with their loved ones or family members at a level that they can understand. And there must be an appreciation that different people, of course, will have different literacy skills and reading skills, and every individual will come from a different mindset and a different culture, and the communication to them about their disease should take all of those things into mind. What the disease is, what's going to happen, what can be done about it. They should be told that the expectation is that they will participate as full partners in all the important decisions. So in medical lingo, this is called joint decision making. And yet, this sometimes occurs. Again, many wonderful practitioners out there, physicians and nurses and others. But it often doesn't occur, and you know, healthcare providers often feel that their role is to give information and to tell the patient what to do, because after all, they have the knowledge and the patient does not. Healthcare providers and doctors have been trained that way, so it's natural for them to possess that point of view. But I mean, think about it. With a serious chronic disease with a high mortality rate, surely patients and their family members should be partners in their care and have a lot to say about important decisions that are taken. And the same with...
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I stepped on.
Well, I would say, you know, the same applies to their end-of-life wishes. You know, the really essential that discussions take place that clarify what the patient prefers at the end of life, and then that those discussions continue while the patient is on dialysis, because individuals may change their mind about things as their disease progresses. And again, sadly, various reports show that this doesn't happen anywhere close to the degree that it should, and that many patients with chronic kidney failure die without their end-of-life wishes being honored. And that's really tragic. So these are just some examples. There are many more, but the bottom line, you know, from my point of view, is that, gosh, we focus on the urea clearances and on the dry weights and on the blood counts and on the biochemistry, and we focus so much on those things. Shouldn't we be focusing more on the softer and more human aspects of this disease?
I seem to have found that out ourselves here. You know, we've talked to patients. Sometimes these patients are having some stress, having some problems with their unit. But I've asked the majority of them. I said, well, when you first found out that you were going to be on dialysis, how much information were you given before you started becoming a dialysis patient? And the majority of the people say they never really got any information. They just, one day they were sick, they were told they were going to become a dialysis patient. They became a dialysis patient and without really knowing the process, what was going to happen to them, what their feelings would be, what the physiological and the mental things, that ordeals that they would be going through. And so I agree with you. There has to be something that treats the patient more so that they understand, but also they need to take responsibility, and their family does too. So some of us have heard about patient and family engagement and how important it is. Tell us about it and what your thoughts are on that.
Well, all those things that I mentioned, and they were just some examples, pre-dialysis care, patient education, end-of-life planning, joint decision-making, they're all issues that that can be dealt with if a health system or a dialysis clinic or patients and families themselves decide that their mission is to be fully engaged in their care, to be full partners in their care. And that's, you know, the medical buzzword is patient engagement or patient activation. But it's just being human beings, treating other human beings reasonably, actually. You know, we hear a lot about patient-centered care. In almost every hospital and health system, when you look at their website information, they'll talk about how patient-centered they are. DaVita does, just as an example. You know, I always like to say that patient-centered care is best observed when it's absent. When you see a patient and a provider in conflict and both of them leaving angry, you can say, aha, that's not patient-centered care. But patient engagement, which in my view is a more important concept than patient-centered care, patient engagement is recognized when it's present. And I'll give you some examples. So when patient and family engagement exists, patients insist that they are going to learn about and understand their disease and what's going to happen and what's going to be done. Engaged patients are comfortable expressing their fears and their anxieties. They're not intimidated. They are perfectly happy to question. And, you know, one of the things about activated patients or engaged patients and families is that it's said they talk more and listen less, so that healthcare providers end up talking less and listening more. And quite frankly, that's not the way it often is in dialysis units. Engaged patients will insist on exploring their options. Am I going to have home hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis or no dialysis and conservative care only? Am I going to have a transplant or not? And they want to be understanding of those options, and they want to be involved in decisions around them. And they also want, and studies have demonstrated this, it's really surprising. They want to focus on their quality of life. You know, studies have said, and dialysis patients have been interviewed, and these are scientific studies published. What's more important to you, having great biochemistry and great urea clearances and living a little longer, or having a better quality of life and having your symptoms relieved? And the overwhelming proportion says, you know what, patients say, I'll take less life of higher quality with fewer symptoms. You know, I want the human side of my disease dealt with. So, you know, that's, as I say, patient engagement is recognized when it's present, and that's what you would see in a dialysis unit where there's patient engagement. You'd see very activated patients who are playing a much greater partnership role in the management of their disease. And then, Bill, as you mentioned, coming with that, the patients are ending up being more accountable. If you want to be involved in decisions, then you have to be prepared to accept the consequences of those, and so you get greater degrees of patient accountability, which is a good thing.
Right. Well, I've talked to patients, and a lot of patients, the one thing, the overall understanding I get from the people is that they want a quality of life, and most of all, they want dignity. They want personal dignity. They don't feel there's any dignity in the dialysis process for many of them. So, what you're talking about, it sounds great, but what needs to be done in the typical dialysis unit to actually make sure patients and family engagement exist?
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to happen by accident, or it's not going to happen because a group of people sort of sit around and think it would be a good idea. It will only happen if there's a plan. And because we're really talking about culture change, and culture change, you know, as many of us would know, is hard to achieve in countries or in dialysis units. And it's particularly hard to achieve if the leadership isn't playing a major role in that culture change. So for patient engagement to take hold in a dialysis unit, ideally, you want the commitment of leadership. You want the physicians and the administrative leaders and the nursing leaders to say, this is a really good idea. You want the patients and their family members to be energized and passionate. And, you know, this is a barrier. I mean, patients often come for dialysis 3 times a week. They go home. They're often feeling a little wasted. You ask them to spend more time coming to group meetings or being involved in the patient engagement process, and they may just feel that they just spend enough time as it is. So that's a barrier that must be overcome. Really important to ensure that the patients and the providers, and I'll just emphasize this, the patients and the providers have the necessary skills for patient engagement. And I'll just provide a simple example. Communication. you know, there have been studies done that show that when doctors receive formal communication training, particularly training around difficult discussions, their performance improves markedly. And if they don't have that kind of training, it's easy for doctors always just to default to the lab tests and to the dry weight and to the urea clearance and to the hemoglobin, et cetera. And that's what they do. The studies show it. But by the same token, patients have to learn how to be better communicators. It's a skill. It doesn't necessarily happen spontaneously. And there are some wonderful tools out there that give patients guidance about how they can be better communicators with their healthcare providers. So I'm just using that as an example of the kind of skills that need to be learned. You know, learning how to engage in joint decision making, learning about how advanced care planning and end-of-life care planning should really happen. These things need to be thought about and learned, both the patients and the providers. And then, you know, a unit would need to have some way of determining whether it's making any progress in its effort or not. I'm just going to make a sidebar comment here, because I'm just imagining amongst the listeners, there's a little bit of the rolling of the eyes right now. Like, how are we ever going to do this? I would just point you to the End-Stage Renal Disease Network of Texas, Network 14, their website. If you go online and you Google patient engagement, End-Stage Renal Disease Network of Texas, they have a wonderful website with all kinds of terrific information for patients about how to move toward becoming more activated or engaged. So I would just describe that as one really helpful source of information.
Okay. So the patient engagement actually makes a difference and has been shown to the doctor and the patient engagement thing does have a higher quality of life. And how about as far as fewer readmissions? Do the people adhere to their treatment plan? Because a lot of times we've see where the patient kind of gets discouraged and they don't really actually follow their treatment plan, even though it's to their best interest to do that.
Yep. Well, the scientific data on this is emerging, and it would suggest that where programs or health systems working with their patients and their family members have developed patient engagement programs, the patient satisfaction levels are higher, the patient outcomes are better, there are fewer visits to the emergency room, there are fewer readmissions. So the patients clearly do better. But interestingly, the provider systems benefit also because costs are reduced. Staff satisfaction actually goes up, and staff turnover is reduced. So there are many positive things from both the patient and family members' points of view, and also the provider systems' points of view, that make moving toward higher levels of patient engagement something that should be really important for a kidney program.
Well, I imagine some doctors and nurses and clinics may resist a move towards greater engagement of patients and their families because they believe it will just take too much time. What would you say to them?
Well, I think you just, I'll just share some anecdotes with you in spending some time in clinics where they have really focused on patient engagement. The nurses actually report that they were, and so the doctors, that they were really worried that how can I do this? We can hardly get through our day as it is. But when working with engaged patients, they actually found that patient flow was more efficient, and the time constraints were eased as opposed to increased. And if you think about it, it makes sense. So engaged patients will, you know, when they're coming to the clinic or they're coming to the outpatient facility or the doctor's office, they are going to know what problems are front of mind for them. And it's those problems, the ones that are front of mind to the patient, that are the ones that are most important to deal with. So they will have identified them, they'll have thought about them, they'll be able to express them, they will have read a little bit about them, and the whole consultation, patient management process is eased, and you know, it becomes much more efficient for patients to be managed. And you know, I won't underestimate the difficulties associated with this. It does require, and nurses have told me this also, it requires a mind shift that can be difficult at first. You know, a patient may come to the dialysis clinic overweight, but if that's not the major issue as characterized by the patient, then that's not the major issue. And nurses may find that very difficult, or physicians. But patients may decide that there are other things that day that are more important to deal with than obsessing over their dry weight or their urea clearance or their hemoglobin. And that does require a mind shift. And that's part of the culture change. But it can be done.
Okay. So you can give us some good news. The patients, families, and providers system, are they making any real progress?
Well, I'd say in the health systems of countries like Canada and the United States, on a broad scale, there's real progress that's being made. You know, it's been characterized by some, and I would characterize it as a patient care revolution that's underway, and the revolution is all about patients taking more responsibility for themselves and being allowed to be partners in their care. And there are many examples of that revolution unfolding in Canadian and in American medicine. In nephrology, in dialysis care, the examples are fewer, but they are starting. So the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, for the last number of years, has required provider organizations to be developing some initiatives related, first of all, to patient-centered care and more recently to patient engagement, and to measure the effectiveness of those and to report back to CMS, which is their funding agency. So that's very positive. You know, I've had the pleasure of visiting some individual units that have really focused on patient engagement, and again, as I've described, from both a provider and a patient point of view, are very satisfied with the results. In Canada, a couple of the large dialysis provider organizations, and in Canada with our healthcare system, these would be provincial government organizations. So, for example, in Ontario and in British Columbia, they're both committed to enhancing the engagement of dialysis patients, and they've committed to working together to develop a toolkit for dialysis units to use if they want to travel that path, so that every hospital or health system or dialysis unit doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. So there are good things happening. In a previous talk, you heard from Dori Chattel from the Medical Education Institute. You know, great work going on there in improving the education of patients with the serious chronic disease of kidney failure. So there are some what I refer to as sprigs of hope, but they're not as robust as I would have thought they might be. And you know, I ask myself why. Because if you look at chronic kidney failure, it's such a serious disease. It's not going to go away. You'd think patients would be particularly active participants in the revolution that's underway, where patients and their families are gaining more control over their care. But I see dialysis patients as being laggards, not leaders in this area. And you know, I kind of wonder whether it's because many patients feel vulnerable and they feel intimidated, and maybe they worry that if they're going to speak out or question or demand more education or want to be involved in important decisions, that they run the risk of being characterized as problem patients, and that can have really disastrous results. So that's just an hypothesis. I don't know. But much work to be done in this area in dialysis, for sure.
I've read your book, Sorrow's Reward, and it takes place in a fictional dialysis unit. Why did you write it, and how does it tie in with what we've been talking about?
Well, first of all, thank you for reading it. I always appreciate hearing
that. It was a wonderful book. It really opened up.
Well, you know, after many years of being involved with dialysis care from different vantage points, I decided that it could be powerful, if done properly, to write a book that allowed fictional patients and doctors and healthcare providers and administrators to speak from their heart about what they're really feeling. Based on their experiences, and so that was the focus of the book, or one of the foci of the book. And you know, what I was really trying to get at was that the health systems can talk about patient-centered care all they want, and they can put it on their websites, and they can put it on their brochures, and they can do the same with patient engagement, but I tried through this book to let whomever read it know that patients know that those things don't generally exist. And as a consequence, they are suffering when they should not be suffering. So that was a major reason why I wrote the book. And, you know, I've had some feedback that would suggest that goal has been met. But I also wrote the book thinking that a dialysis unit is like a little town. It's like a little community, really. And the patients are there for long periods of time. It's not a transient patient population. And I felt that what one sees in a dialysis unit and feels and experiences there can apply to life in general. And therefore, I thought the book might be interesting to patients without kidney disease also. And I've had some feedback that's the case, so that's been encouraging.
Well, that was my experience in reading your book. I was, after reading your book, there's one particular area in there where you talk about the layers of paint, and I'm an older gentleman now, and I realize that I'm having to go back and do my part and scrape away some of the layers of the paint.
I've had many people talk to me about that particular.
Well, that is a very good point. I mean, it's very apropos. I mean, I think a lot of people will see that and go, "Wow, you know, how much paint have I put down in my life?" And as you get older, you go back and reflect on things and say, "You know, you need to do something a little different." Can you give me some examples of the difference between, say, dialysis care in Canada and dialysis care in the United States? I know that you've done work in both areas.
Well, Canada has a universal publicly funded healthcare system, so there is only one insurer, and everyone is insured. So there are no uninsured patients in Canada. And because it's a publicly funded system, and again, I'm not being critical of the United States, I'm just describing the differences. There's no profit motive to dialysis. The dialysis units are run by the system, funded by government, actually. So some of the incentives related to profit that may exist in the United States would never exist in Canada. And you know, we have a very, perhaps because it's a relatively small country, the nephrology community and the nephrology nurses, the nephrology technicians, people get to know one another and we work well together. So, you know, on areas such as pre-dialysis care and joint decision making and end of life care, I would say in Canada it's not perfect. It's much to do. It's not at all perfect, but we've made some progress relative to some of the things that one observes in the United States. Just an example, which I don't fully understand, but it's just a difference. Much more home dialysis in Canada. Much more peritoneal dialysis in Canada. A huge thrust across Canada on what we call independent care. We want patients at home, as to the greatest possible extent, looking after themselves, freed from the responsibility of coming to hospitals or dialysis units or whatever. So that's a big push in Canada. In the United States, you know, my experience is, as it has been wherever I go in the medical sphere, you just meet caring and compassionate healthcare professionals of every stripe who are amazingly committed to their patients. And I mean amazingly committed. But the, you know, the construct of the system in the United States, the fact that it has a business aspect to it, runs the risk of leading to incentives that are not necessarily fully aligned with the needs of the patients. So what comes first, the business interests or the patient's interests? And I can't answer that globally, but it's something that needs to be thought about, and it's not a situation that would occur in Canada.
Well, I think that the how do you think that in the United States the introduction of the for-profits taking over the dialysis clinics and becoming taking the patients and the doctors, has that been good for the United States or bad?
This is where I remember that disclaimer right at the front where you emphasize that the views expressed are the views of the discussant alone. So I'll have to be careful how I frame.
Well, you don't have to answer that if you don't want.
No, I'm happy to answer it. You know, we are all human beings. At the end of the day, there's no security without health security. It's just something that's so fundamental to each of us and to our security and to the securities of our families and loved ones. And I just see it as problematic when you introduce a for-profit business element into this. And, you know, and again, you can't make blanket statements. There are many wonderful units and wonderful practitioners. But, you know, why the low home dialysis rate? You know, why the patients who aren't being fully educated or exposed to their kidney transplant, opportunities.
Well, I know there's some newer home dialysis machines out there that are
yep.
smaller and easier to operate, where you don't.
Yep.
So those are things that certainly would help a lot of people. And when I say things about for profits, I'm not talking about dialysis only. You know, there's a move towards the profit motives within all of the aspects of medical care in the United States. So it's just
right.
not dialysis only, but it is harming patients in a way. As far as the doctors, I know a lot of times are frustrated because when they want, they don't have quite the control they used to have over their patient, and sometimes
right.
they're directed on what drugs they can administer and when
right.
they can, and so
it's
just a hard thing to come through and have. One thing that I would like to address here is I know the difference. I'd like to know the difference between the technicians in Canada and the technicians in the United States. I know here in the United States that I don't think they're as well-trained as the ones in Canada, or there is caring. Not that there aren't a lot of caring technicians out there, but I don't think the system that we have in place here in the United States for the training of our technicians is as good. Can you say state anything about that?
I can indeed. First of all, much more of the bedside dialysis care in Canada would be conducted by fully accredited dialysis nurses who have achieved special certificates of competence in nephrology. In Canada, the dialysis technicians, that term generally is used for persons who help maintain the machines, etc. So the first observation I would make is in Canada, one is more likely to have more highly educated and highly skilled certified individuals engaged in things such as needling the patients when at dialysis. And there are standards, and that if one's going to do that work, one has to be accredited. In the United States, it's much more scattered. So the National Association of Dialysis Nurses and Technicians has outlined a clear set of paths through which dialysis technician accreditation can be achieved. But just out of interest in thinking about this evening's talk, I looked up, and I'm not picking on any company, it just happened to be, I looked up job descriptions, job openings for a dialysis patient care technician for one particular company, and I saw that the qualifications were pretty soft. In other words, demonstrated completion of applicable state requirements, certification preferred or as required by state regulation, 6 months dialysis experience preferred. So, there are a number of requisite skills that are characterized as being preferred but not necessary, that in other jurisdictions, in Canada would be just one example, they would be absolutely necessary. I sound like I'm promoting Canada's healthcare system. I am not. It's a difference. We're a smaller country. In each province, there's just one healthcare system. It's easier to have policies and regulations and to ensure that they're enforced and that things are more standardized. It's a much more complex situation in the United States, but you shouldn't be apologized for it. I mean, it has some deficiencies that need to be corrected, and how dialysis technicians are employed and the skills they have, particularly when it comes to needling fistulas, I mean, that's not a trivial matter.
Right, we've had a lot of patients who are...
Do those comments help? I mean,
Yes, the needling is actually a very large part of some of the complaints that we have on the patients, because they're, you know, it's painful if they have the wrong type of person who doesn't have the skills. And so if you think about that each 3 times a week, you're going to go back and you're going to go through, you know, there are a lot of people don't like to even have a shot. Every 3 years or something, let alone have it 3 times a week, and have to go back and realize that you're going to get some pain. Anyway. So that's one thing that goes on. The other question I have is, in Canada, are there any regulations on how many patients, the ratio of patients to a technician when they're in the unit?
Yep, there are accepted standards. Yep.
Okay, they have a certain amount of ones that can.
Because
I know in the United States, when my wife was first started, she would do 3 patients at a time. She was able to go back and check their blood pressure and do the other thing, get the next machine ready for the next patient. And, we've heard stories of 6, 8, 9 patients, which seems to me to
well, that would not occur in Canada, but what would occur is that not all dialysis units would be considered the same. So an in-hospital dialysis unit where patient acuity would be high, the nurse-to-patient ratio would be low. A community dialysis unit where acuity is low, the standards for nurse-patient ratios would be different. And then in Canada, the system is very much moving toward, even dialysis units where patients do their own needling and participate in their own care and come in at night to do nocturnal dialysis in a hospital. And, of course, the nurse-to-patient ratios under those circumstances the ratios are greater. Patients are a lot healthier.
Well, obviously, the points that you point out here, the things that need to be done, would greatly help the patients here in the United States. And I do believe that if we raise the standards for the people that are needling and the technicians and made them pass some testing, that we could raise the health of the patients that we have. Right now, we do have a crisis here in the United States with our dialysis centers. I believe that we're getting more and more information out there to people. People are becoming aware of it. People like yourself are willing to come out and discuss this, which was, for you being a nephrologist, that's a great thing that you've done for the patients and the other people within the dialysis. I know you can probably catch some flack for doing that in your industry, but we certainly appreciate that. At this time, I'd like to see if we've got area code 202 here. Have you got anything you'd like to ask?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, have you ever seen anyone come off of dialysis after being on for several years? I think the kidney failure was induced by the drugs given in the treatment, such as allowing a lot of blood loss, transfusions, drug-induced antibiotics like the gentamicin. This is how my son was treated. And he had a normal urination until one visit to the hospital. They just allowed him to almost hemorrhage to death over the weekend from a simple few stitches that weren't done when they changed the catheter in his chest where he's dialyzed. And that's when he shut down from urinating.
Well, to answer your question, it doesn't happen often, but there can be situations where a patient is thought to have chronic kidney failure and is on dialysis, and then over time their kidney function improves. And a common cause of that would be, for example, kidney failure that's related to the use of some of the common anti-inflammatory medications. And when dialysis is started, if those medications are withdrawn, then kidney function could improve over time. So it's not common, but it does happen. The occasional patient is able to regain enough function to come off dialysis.
Oh, well, thank you for the hope.
Of course.
Okay, well, thank you for calling. We appreciate your input, and we'll get back to you there. Right now,
I have one more comment. My son said anytime I get involved, he is retaliated. And I've noticed with the motivation of the corporate structure and to twine with the medical field, the attitude is very controlling, and it's like someone guarding their money, their golden calf, whereas they have more of a health and nurturing perspective.
Appreciate your input, and get back to you there. Yeah, area code 646, if you turn your radio off, and we'll get background music there, or background feedback. So go on with your question there.
Me? I'm still on there?
Yeah, you were talking about the retaliation.
Yeah, there is retaliation. My son said to me, Mom, he said, every time you ask all these questions, and I did notice, I've actually been escorted out of the hospital with my daughter for giving my son water after being dialyzed, and oftentimes he's drugged, and then given dialysis, and he went simple glass of water, which we got right there in the hospital, and we were put out the hospital by the police. I mean, it's often something interchangeable now going on here, and they're all on the same team.
You know, I think it is. I think you do raise an important issue, and it's a topic possibly for another discussant to have on this show. But the issue of patient intimidation and retaliation is really an important issue, and so I thank you for raising it.
Thank you.
I'm going to try our next person here. Area code 646, if you'd like to come on, if you can turn your background radio on. Hello, area code 646.
The topic possibly.
I'm sorry, anybody, listeners, you need to turn your radio off and listen on the phone. Otherwise, it comes on as nothing but background noise. So we've got that there. Yes, I would like to talk to you in the future about some of the things that go on with the retaliation. I know a lot of patients do have fear. Anytime their machine is turned so they can't see it, that seems to be a big fear factor for them. They don't know what the technician is doing when they can't see the machine.
Yep.
And they know that if the technician turns up the speed of the machine, how much is pumping, that they go into cramps. Yeah, so there's another way to retaliate against someone if they question or ask what's on.
Yep.
And so we have those patients who want to know everything about the process, and then we have the patients don't want to know anything. Yeah, so there's both ends of the spectrum there. And same thing with families. You know, there's a lot of families that are involved with the care of their family member, and there's other ones that don't want to be involved at all. And there were some very good examples of that in your book, Zara's Reward. Unfortunately, that happens all the time.
Yep.
Is there anything else that you'd like to cover, Dr. Baer, on that this time?
No, I would just conclude by saying that, as one of the callers mentioned, we are a team, the patients, the family, the doctors, the nurses, the other healthcare providers, and we really have to make sure that we're working as a team to deliver truly caring and compassionate care to this very suffering and vulnerable population. And that's our challenge, but it can be done, and I choose to look upon it as just a great opportunity.
Well, I'd like to thank you for coming on our show, and I'd like to wish everybody that's listening that's those that are going to listen to it through the archives, please pick up and read Sorrow's Reward. I think that you'll find that it's very engaging. It talks, it's very very well read, very well written, and it's about what's going on today in dialysis. But I think there will be some of you will be surprised when you read this and find out that it will have some relevations about your own life and what's been going on with you yourself. So at this time, we're going to end the show, and I'd like to thank Dr. Barrett for being on board. I thank those of you that listened. It doesn't seem that anybody wants to comment other than our people. But, again, thanks, and we'll see you down the road here. Dr. Barrett, we'll get back with you here in a minute, okay?
Yep.
All right.
Yep.
Thank you.